Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine one subject in the news, and that is the revolution going on in Egypt. Since the revolution in Egypt is being driven by young people who are taking to the streets because they feel their future has been stolen by Mubarak and his cronies, we'll begin in a moment and get the perspective of Jessica El-Sayed, a young 17-year-old reporter in Alexandria, Egypt, who was a senior reporter with Youth Journalism International. Then we will talk with Samia Sarageldin in Cairo. She wrote the autobiographical novel The Cairo House that traces political developments in Egypt over the past three decades. She will give us an update on what is happening in Cairo. And then for a broader perspective on the momentous changes underway in the Arab world and the extent to which demands for freedom and democracy will spread, we'll be joined by Ambassador Clovis Maksoud, the Arab League's former ambassador to the United States and the United Nations. Let's now go to Alexandria, Egypt. I'm speaking with Jessica El-Sayed, who's a 17-year-old student in Alexandria, Egypt. She's a senior reporter with Youth Journalism International. And Jessica, today I take it the military showed up in the streets. And what you've reported is that the looting that's going on is actually being conducted by the police. And that's, of course, not what is being reported, particularly in Egypt.
Well, yes, they have been looting the streets, public and private property, have been secured by normal citizens since last night. And many of the people that they've caught and took out their ID cards, they found that they work with the police, some even with the secret police. This is, of course, like you said, the complete opposite of what's being even said in the Egyptian state television. The people are the ones that are protecting everything. So this is why everyone is trusting what they're having to say and not necessarily what the TV says. They cut off Al Jazeera, which is the main television channel that people here watch. So it's for some simple citizens, it's even hard to get the truth out of what's happening. But mostly people are living with the event, and they're down in the streets either protecting their houses or protesting. And that's pretty much the sense that we have right now.
And Jessica El-Sayed, I believe that a lot of Egyptians feel that the release of the prisoners and the fact that, as you've reported, the police and the secret police are behind a lot of the looting, that is a tactic on Mubarak's part to create chaos so that he can then justify his strong hand and the need for law and order. Is that your analysis?
I believe this is correct. Lots of people here believe this is correct. We all believe that Mubarak is... He's the one that is, he and his regime are trying to stir terror in the people. He's trying to scare them into just silencing themselves and going back home. Because he's terrified, because this has been the first time he's been in office, that the people have gathered together in numbers large enough to have their voices heard. I heard lots of reports today about the inmates that are running out of police, out of prisons, were not, some of them, of course, were escaping, but others were, they were forced to leave because since yesterday there have been no police in the country whatsoever, at least in my city of Alexandria and Cairo and Suez. Police are nowhere to be found, so people in the prisons, the inmates, have no food, have no water. There's just, they have access to nothing. So they had to leave. It wasn't necessarily, I mean, some of the prisoners have called news channels here and told their stories. And as an Egyptian myself, I believe them above any responsible figure in the Egyptian regime.
Again, I'm speaking with Jessica El-Sayed, who's a 17-year-old student in Alexandria, Egypt. She's a senior reporter with Youth Journalism International. Just to touch on the military, Jessica, I understand that there's a real dilemma there. On the one hand, the people welcome the military. They hate the police. They respect the military. But if the military is forced to create law and order because Mubarak has ordered the police to in effect create chaos, do you foresee a problem there, or what's your understanding of the relationships between the people on the streets and the military on the streets?
Well, there is still a state of confusion about that specific issue here. Even for us, because one moment we were all trusting that the military was standing with the people. We've had a curfew since 4 p.m. Our curfew starts at 4 p.m. here in Alexandria and Cairo and Suez. Yet the people just were on the street. Now there's about 100,000 people in Al-Tahrir Square in Cairo. So everyone felt that the military was not trying to suppress the protests. They weren't violent with the people. People were trying to help them, actually. And then later on today, there were military Air Force airplanes and a couple of helicopters that were flying across the Al-Tahrir Square in Cairo, and also a couple passed by here in Alexandria. Very close to the ground, very, very near to the protesters. We believe that it happened because Mubarak wants to scare, like I said before, the protesters into going home. And the complete opposite happened because the more this happened, the more an airplane passed by them, the cheers were louder. The people didn't move an inch. They're very, very determined to stay there until the dictator is down.
And the dictator's cronies, I mean, I take it, the what I keep seeing in the coverage, and as you reported, Jessica El-Sayed, that Al Jazeera has been cut off, but there's still some coverage we see here in the U.S. The refrain that you keep hearing from the young people in the streets is that Mubarak and his cronies have stolen their future. And one very eloquent and angry young man was saying, these are spoiled people. They have taken all the jobs, all the money. They are spoiled. I thought it was very touching. So does that agree with your sense of what's happening there and what's motivating the young people?
Yes. The Hosni Mubarak and his regime have been stealing people's rights for years. They've been stealing young people's opportunities for years. There's no place for anyone who does not have power in government or excessive wealth to have any chance to do anything productive with their lives here. Some of my friends and even relatives have graduated from college 7 years ago and still can't find jobs. The educational system is a reflection of his dictatorship in the sense that even lesson plans are made to suppress people and say that the Egyptian state is stable. There's nothing wrong with it. We've had a 7,000-year-old civilization, and just rubbing off on that and not allowing any space for anything new. I think, like I've said with the piece on YJIblog.org, was that someone who was born 30 years ago has seen nothing but him, has seen no change whatsoever. And that's the state with all the youth here. They're very frustrated. There's no opportunity for them to think about. People here don't have dreams, really, if you ask someone and say, well, what are your dreams? Sometimes most of the time, there's just no answer because they understand that the road is blocked, that every opportunity that there is for them to have is taken by someone with higher connections. the National Democratic Party is the most corrupted, I think, party in, I mean, at least in the world, maybe because I'm emotional, but some of its members, a lot of its members are actually businessmen, like Ahmed Ez, who fled yesterday and his wife to London, because they know, because they understand what they've done. He owns the monopoly for a steel and iron company in Egypt, and in one day he raised steel from 3,000 Egyptian pounds to 5,000 Egyptian pounds because he has that power. And it's just known, business and politics cannot go hand in hand, at least in Egypt, without an excessive state of corruption.
And Jessica, what do you know about reports that the designated heir by Mubarak, his son Gamal, fled some time ago in a private jet with his family, supposedly for London as well?
Yes, we have heard about that statement yesterday. Everyone believed it, and as soon as we heard it, I mean, we heard, you know, streets cheering and people cheering because he was, I mean, one of the major concerns. For the past couple of years, everyone has been saying that he would be the successor in the coming September elections. So the fact that he's gone is a relief, but we're still just anticipating reassurance that he's gone forever. Yaron Mubarak, although he's never come out and said that I'm going to run for president, even despite that, there's been posters in my city, posters in Cairo, posters everywhere saying, yes, we support you. And those posters are made by officials in the government, officials in the police, just to brainwash people into thinking that it's okay. Lots of people from the NDP come on TV and say that he has all right to run for president. It's the same as him running as anyone else, which is completely false. Our constitution leaves no space for almost, I mean, anyone to have the right qualifications to run for president. And that's one of the main demands for the people protesting today, is that the Constitution needs to change, the whole regime needs to change, not just specific individuals in the government.
And again, I'm speaking with Jessica El-Sayed, who's a 17-year-old student in Alexandria, Egypt. She's a senior reporter with Youth Journalism International, and her latest report is available online at ygiblog.org. Is that right? That's the right address?
YGI.
YGI, yeah. Or J-I, yeah, J, for journalism, Youth Journalism International, yjiblog.org. And in your latest piece that I think I congratulate you on the clarity of your writing, it's very, very, really great reporting, you say that Egyptians are very upset with U.S. President Barack Obama and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton for failing to back them. The Americans must choose between the Egyptian people and the government. Is that a widespread feeling amongst Egyptians?
Yes, I believe so. It's not necessarily a feeling that I have or my family. It's even today when the man of the moment right now, Mohamed Ebrahde, was on CNN, he stated it himself. He just expressed all of Egypt's frustration. It just, why can he not come out and say, down with the dictator? Why the support? We're confused. We don't understand. We see America as, everyone here sees America as the beacon of freedom. We see them as the people that have liberty, they have rights, they understand, what it means to have real liberty. And it was just so surprising for us not surprising, but upsetting, I guess, like I said before. Today, Hillary Clinton came out and spoke again, but still, no one is satisfied. She says the transition of power needs to be peaceful. Well, we understand, of course, we want peaceful transition of power, but what she doesn't understand is that we do not want transition of power in people. I think she means the transition of the government, like what has happened. President Mubarak has changed a couple of officials in the government. But then he replaced them with military officials in the Air Force, who he himself is an Air Force official. So again, there's still no change. That was a peaceful transition, and that's what Hillary Clinton called for, and that's not necessarily at all what we want. We want him to leave, not just decline from office. We want him to leave the country. Lots of people, including myself, want him to be trialed because not even for the past, but for the past week. Today's the sixth day of protests and riots, and everything that has been ruined in Egypt. I mean, they came into the Egyptian museum and broke the heads off mummies and some of the inmates. And the Egyptian state television will make you think that this was the work of rioters and protesters to make you think that that's what we're out to do, destroy the country. Even though what we know and what we believe is that some of the police had specific instructions to go and do specifically that, because they didn't steal things from the museum. They just broke it. And lots of poor Egyptians don't even understand, even though they're Egyptian, don't understand the value of these these symbols of our culture. So that was planned. It's difficult to watch the model for someone who says, freedom for all, not stand for the freedom of the people, of our people.
Well, Jessica, I must say that in fact, in response to your writing at yjiblog.org, the people that have responded to your piece, one of them here in the United States, says, "Your story and the story of the Egyptian people is truly inspiring. As an American, I'm ashamed that the U.S. has supported Mubarak for so many years, and doubly ashamed that we're not doing more to support this revolution. I wish you all the best." So that indicates that the American people are not the same as the American government, just as clearly the case is in Egypt, that the Egyptian people are quite different from the Egyptian government. It does feel in many ways that even though you just... It's depressing, I must say, that the government is so out of touch with the people in both the United States and in Egypt.
Yes, I do understand. It's very common now, I think, with the misinterpretations of the media and things like that, to make faulty generalizations that lead to times like when times like this come. It's difficult for the government to get the message.
Isn't he a particularly remote and paranoid figure? He's kind of in a state of delusion, Mubarak. He's ruled this country for 30 years, and he simply doesn't seem to understand what's happening on the streets. His cronies seem to understand because they've gotten out of town with all the money that they could steal.
Yeah. We're so used to seeing him be so power thirsty that we're not necessarily shocked from this. We know that it's going to be a hard battle. Till now, I know that today being the sixth day is nothing. That this may keep going till the end of the month if it has to, but it has to be bad before it gets good. The way I see it, Mubarak is completely. I think he's. I don't know how this could happen to a human being, but he's completely brainwashed to think that because he has a couple of supporters in the government who are filthy rich, because he's corrupted them that way, that he's allowed them to live a life where they can't say anything. How could you get up and say to the person that gives you all these luxuries, no, I don't want you, your policies are just insane. been in the state of emergency for the past 30 years. People, oppositions have been calling, opposition parties have been calling for years, saying, why? Why do we still have the state of emergency? And yet, no response whatsoever. Mubarak, he came out to talk four days after the protests, completely ignoring the fact that they exist, as if, you know, we have people from the NDP come out and say, yes, people have the right to freedom of expression. At this point, it's much more intense than just freedom of expression. People aren't—they're not expressing themselves now. They're expressing their demands. They're demanding something. They're not telling you that we're dissatisfied with the regime. We're demanding you to leave. It's a country of 85 million people. And he everyone here, if you talk to anyone, they'll tell you that Mubarak has just made us so undignified. He's ruined our image to, I believe that he's ruined our image everywhere in the world. There's so much good in Egypt that isn't exposed because of his regime. Scientists and artists just young people that have so many big dreams that can't do anything. So it's frustrating. People are poor, people are uneducated, and he thinks that he can continue to brainwash us. There's so much technology now, and even on TV talking about how social media has influenced this. It really has. People cannot be brainwashed any longer. They're very, very much unblinded to what Mubarak has done. So even if we were silent before, we cannot be silenced now.
And Jessica, just in closing, do you feel that this revolution, this hard-won revolution that the young people of Egypt have risked their lives to bring about, at least 100 have been killed so far, and you're saying it could go on for days, but at the end of the day, do you think that the young Egyptians are going to hold on to their revolution and the values for which they are standing now in the streets? Or do you think it's possible that, for example, there's a lot of analysts over here believe, and you know that Mubarak has used the Muslim Brotherhood as an excuse for his oppression, but there is a fear that because the Muslim Brotherhood are the most organized political opposition, that all of the work of these young Egyptians could be co-opted by the Muslim Brotherhood, who can end up taking charge. So give us a sense of where you think the political future of Egypt will be in terms of the possibility of this, all of the aspirations that you've expressed, which many of which I think are entirely shared by Islamists.
I think that if finally we'd be able to create dissolve the NDP and create a new government with a new president with just new blood all over it, the young people will stand with next to their beliefs. I mean, they're not going to waste all the time they spent on the streets and the money, and I mean, it just so much more sacrifices than appears to the eye, you know, leaving their families. I do believe that the change will be effective, and it will not be suppressive again, ever. Like you said, Mubarak has used the Muslim Brotherhood as an excuse for his regime. He's the one, I believe, that has even ruined the image of Islam as a religion as a whole to the West. Because now you hear Muslim Brotherhood, and the next word you think is violence. This is completely 100% not true. What he has done is scared the people here in Egypt. Even people here are brainwashed to think that, I mean, through many, many years, not just brainwashed in the sense that they're being told and they believe, but this is the way they were raised. It's written in their books and their history books that this is the enemy. And people have woken up. They just, they're not the enemy. They're just the opposition. The problem that Mubarak had with the Muslim Brotherhood was not that they're the Muslim Brotherhood as anything, actually, just because they oppose him. It's a problem. The same way people opposing him in Tahrir Square right now is a problem. I do not believe that it's going to be a violent state. There are so many different parties in Egypt that there's no light on. I just right now read that Mohamed Ebrahdi will be the head of a new parallel, I think, government that's not necessarily official, but he would be part of the movement that would involve many different opposition parties, including the Muslim Brotherhood, who initially disliked Mohamed Ebrahdi. He's the man of the moment right now, extremely moderate man, Nobel Peace Prize winner. There's no way if change comes to Egypt, the ripple effect will be very, very good. I don't see anything dark in that future, but just hopefully the protests continue to happen. People aren't getting tired, they aren't getting bored. It's moving.
Well, I really appreciate you joining us here today, Jessica El-Sayed. Again, a 17-year-old student in Alexandria, Egypt. She's a senior reporter with Youth Journalism International. You can read her work at yjiblog.org. And stay safe and stay in touch.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye. And hello again, I'm Ian Masters, and I'm just speaking then with Jessica El-Sayed, who's a senior reporter with Youth Journalism International. Her reports are at yjiblog.org. She grew up in Oakland, or she was born in Oakland, California, of Egyptian parents, grew up in Egypt, is a student in Alexandria, and wants to go to UC Berkeley School of Journalism, and frankly, they'd be lucky to get her. Let's now take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about what's going on in Cairo. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Let's now go to Cairo, Egypt. I'm speaking with Samia Sarah-Geldin, who's a writer, political essayist, editor, and literary critic. She was born and raised in Egypt, educated in Europe, and then emigrated to the United States. Her autobiographical novel, The Cairo House, traces political developments in Egypt over the past three decades, including the rise of Islamism and Sadat's assassination. She joins us today from Cairo. And thank you for joining us again, giving us an update on where we stand today. It seems that Mubarak is holding on. His inner circle is diminishing. His cronies are fleeing in their private jets with all their loot. The students and the young people are not leaving the streets. The military is on the streets. The police have disappeared. The police may well be behind the looting. I'd like to ask you about that, actually. Why don't we begin with that? Is it true, as we've heard, that the police are either turning a blind eye or actively involved in looting? And is the regime letting people out of jail in order to create chaos so that they can turn around and say, you need us to bring law and order?
That seems to be the general perception. First, the lack of police presence in the streets was very much in response to the demands of the demonstrators and of everybody, because the police were generally anathema, very, very unpopular because of so many incidents of police brutality, not just against the Muslim Brotherhood and organizations like that, but just in general. And the chief, not the chief of police, but the Minister of the Interior, who controlled the police in Egypt, was very, very much a hated figure in Egypt. And that's why the Ministry of Interior has been under attack day after day and is cordoned off by the military and under protection. So the police were taken off the streets because the crowds were attacking them, not physically attacking them, but calling for their being taken off the streets, and they were taken off the streets at first in response to popular demand. But the lack of police presence also meant that that looters, that the criminal elements in society, particularly since the three major prisons outside. Most of the prisons are in the outskirts of Cairo, but the three major prisons have prisoners have been released. The prisons have been attacked. The prisons have been released, including, of course, the criminal element. It is widely believed that this could only happen with the collusion of the authorities, and the intention is to heighten the sense of insecurity, which so far has been minimized by the very comforting neighborhood committees that have been set up in every street, every building, every alley, and they've been largely responsible for keeping the peace on the streets. The curfew has been very early, 4 o'clock in the afternoon yesterday, 4 o'clock in the afternoon today, but it's been to some extent ignored, certainly where the major protests are taking place, like Tahrir Square. Curfew is entirely ignored, but otherwise it's more or less observed. And again, it's the neighborhood watch committees who are enforcing some kind of policing presence. But here and there, the military also has come in response to calls for shooting, or where there seems to be a danger. People have been given numbers. There are certain numbers that have been broadcast that you can call, and the military police or the military will come in response to those calls, but not the police. That's been the status, which is very unusual for it to be military who come into neighborhoods in response to complaints from citizens that there is danger or that they're looting. Otherwise, it's mostly, as I said, just people, residents and buildings, doorkeepers as well, shopkeepers, domestics, businessmen, students, lawyers, doctors. The men mostly take to the streets at night and take shifts, holding whatever they have, broomsticks or cudgels. Or largely, by and large, the Egyptian population is not an armed one, and so these citizens are at a disadvantage compared to the criminal elements, who occasionally are armed and who have been looting police stations, because police stations all over the country have been attacked. And the arms that were in the police stations have been obtained by the attackers. And so, but in spite of that, by and large, there have been no horrific incidents. Many incidents, but none that were very horrific in nature, which could have been the case otherwise.
Well, we know, for example, Samir Sarageldin, that it was the army that captured the criminals who broke into the National Museum and desecrated a couple of mummies. The idea that that Egypt's historical thousands of years of treasures could be desecrated is pretty horrific. We know that happened in Iraq with the so-called liberation of Iraq. So what is your feeling about Mohammed al-Baradei? Is he, as the young reporter from Alexandria told us earlier, is he the man of the moment to the Egyptian people?
A lot of people would like to see that in him, but at the same time have been have reservations, not about him as a person. He's generally extremely respected, well-respected, but many people feel that his moment has passed, or that events have overtaken him because he was abroad for so long. And because as soon as he came to Egypt, he was basically put under house arrest. And so the feeling that although he himself as a person is widely admired for his integrity, for his honorability, but there's the feeling that he may not be the man of the moment. The Muslim Brotherhood have offered to have him, to support him in elections and such, which of course is not does not at all fit his profile. He is an extremely secular man. But in general, the feeling is that it would have been Berade's moment to seize a few months ago. Now it's not clear that it is his moment to seize. Although, like the other, like the young reporter that you spoke to, most secular, educated, progressive people, like most of the demonstrators on the streets, are of that ilk. We'd like to see Berade come to power, but it's not clear that he has the. For one thing, he does not have the backing of the army, and since he has no power base in the country, he would need probably the endorsement of the army or its backing to come to power. So there, again, it's not clear that that is a viable outcome.
So Mia Sarah-Gelden, again, the author of The Cairo House, which traces the political developments in Egypt over the last three decades, including the rise of Islamism and Sadat's assassination. She's joining us from Cairo. If Egypt follows the Tunisian model, where you had the young people took to the streets, they drove out the dictator and the kleptocrat and his crooked family and cronies, and then the military stepped into the vacuum, and that's where we stand today, where the real power broker in Tunisia is the very popular general. And it's not unlikely that a similar scenario is going to unfold in Egypt, at least that's the way I see it. Given that the only institution left that the people have any respect for is the military, presumably there would be a transition and then some kind of election. If there were, so walk me through those two possibilities. One, an interim military government, and two, elections. And if the elections were held, who do you think would win?
Well, a military transition is I think almost inevitably the scenario here, because in a power vacuum, the military takes over, and in Egypt, it's very much the case even right now that the military are the ones on the streets. And at the moment, there's a honeymoon period with the mass of the people, and certainly with the demonstrators and the protesters. They actually feel safer with the military on the streets, and so do average citizens. Now, whether or not it would be an interim government is the question here. The military came to power 50 years ago, or 60 years ago now, with Nasser and that coup d'etat. And today, the military have had 60 years of entrenched privileges. And many, many of the military top brass and in general have become very wealthy, very privileged, very entrenched. Whether they would willingly set aside these privileges and just hand over power is not clear. That's one scenario. Now, free and fair elections, that is one thing that is non-negotiable on the streets of Cairo at the moment. And if they did happen, again, you would have the parties that are currently organized. Naturally, since they are currently organized, they would probably make a good showing in the elections. However, the bogeyman scenario that the Mubarak regime had been throwing out at every opportunity, that if free and fair elections, the Muslim Brotherhood would automatically take over the country, that is not going to happen. They are organized. They are one of the better organized parties, although not an official party. They're officially illegal. But even if they were to become legal, or they field candidates at any rate, but they will certainly make a good showing simply because they are organized. But they are highly unlikely to carry off free and fair elections, because the street has shown that that is not where the people are. That's not where the power base is. They do not have the leadership to lead the country. They do not have any charismatic leaders. So they will make a showing, but they will not. It will not be the scenario that has been put forth, and is still being put forth by various media and to some extent by the Mubarak regime on its last legs. That without Mubarak, it's the Muslim Brotherhood who will take over the country.
Well, just in closing.
Go on.
Just in closing then, Samir Sarigeldin, given that the tear gas canisters that are being fired at the protesters are stamped with Made in the USA, and our previous guest, the young reporter with Youth Journalism International from Alexandria, was saying that the Egyptian people are very upset with President Barack Obama and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton for failing to back them, and the Americans must choose between the Egyptian people and the government. Is that a widespread feeling?
I'm afraid it is. I'm afraid it is. I'm very much afraid it is. Any American reporters on the ground will tell you that they themselves, as Americans, face no hostility. People like them as Americans, as people, but that there is a perception that U.S. policy, not today, not just today, but for decades now, has been entirely centered around the security of Israel, and that Egypt and the Egyptian people and their aspirations have not mattered to American foreign policy. What has mattered is a strong regime that could guarantee the security of Israel, a strong regime in Egypt that could guarantee the security of Israel, and that therefore the aspirations of the Egyptian people, the repression that they have been going through, 30 years of martial law, all of that has not mattered. And so you can have the resentment of a people that feel that for all these decades, they have not mattered in the least, and what has mattered is American foreign policy is something entirely different. So there is that resentment, but all it would take is for the U.S. to show that democracy is not just a slogan, that democracy is not just democracy when it delivers results that the U.S. finds fit certain policy prerogatives, for that perception to change. I think Secretary Clinton's remarks and remarks by other world leaders that that democracy per se or elections, free and fair elections per se, may not be the priority of the West or of the U.S. or of U.S. foreign policy. Those are not helpful remarks, but there's no animosity against Americans as such. I think any Americans, any reporters, any tourists who are on the streets of Cairo or any Egyptian city will confirm that they never face any personal hostility. There's nothing personal about it. It's a question of decades of policy.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today on Background Briefing. Samir Sarigeldin, again, author of the autobiographical novel The Cairo House, which traces the political developments in Egypt over the past three decades, including the rise of Islamism and Sadat's assassination. And she joins us today from Cairo. Again, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And hello again, I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. Let's take a brief station break and we'll be back joined by the Arab League's former ambassador to the U.S. and the U.N. And welcome back to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and I'm speaking with Ambassador Clovis Maksud, who's Professor of International Relations and Director of the Center for the Global South at American University in Washington, D.C. Dr. Maksud was the chief representative of the League of Arab States in India, and then he served as the senior editor at Al Haram and then chief editor at Al Nahar Weekly. Ambassador Maksud was appointed as the League of Arab States chief representative to the United States and the United Nations on September 1st, 1979, and on August the 15th, 1990, he submitted his resignation from the League in the aftermath of Iraq's invasion of Kuwait. A lawyer, journalist, and diplomat, Dr. Maksoud is author of several articles and books on the Middle East and the Global South, among them The Meaning of Non-Alignment, The Crisis of the Arab Left, Reflections of Afro-Asianism, and The Arab Image. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ambassador Maksoud.
Thank you.
So what difference is there, essentially, Ambassador Maksoud, between Egypt's government that's now under threat from its people and the government of Morocco, Yemen, Syria, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia?
Well, in view of the record of past differences in historical evolution of these countries and their liberation from different kinds of colonialists and mandates and trustees, therefore, there is a objective reality difference. However, what is common among them is the a large sense of consensus among the people. It demonstrates itself into the immediate, instant identity with their causes, with everybody, whether it's in Iraq or in Lebanon or in Syria and Palestine and in Egypt. There is an immediate, instant reaction and in a way, it communicates itself. So in this respect, for example, what took place in Tunisia, which in a way is a smaller country than Egypt, yet the pattern of authoritarian regime, suppression of the freedom of expression and association, the corruption in the elections and all that, that rebellion, which is called the Yasmin Revolution in Tunisia, which led to the departure of the former dictator president, and the level of corruption that the ruling classes do have in these countries, immediately infected and stimulated and triggered what is taking place at this moment and unraveling in Egypt because of the similarity, but not the identification exactly, the similarity and the fact that the people who suffer the same thing in the Arab world almost have the same reaction to each other's revolutionary achievement. In this case, we find that it didn't take much time for the Tunisian revolution, which attracted the fascinated and was totally unexpected by the Arab people in general, became sort of a trigger and a vanguard for what is taking place at this moment in Egypt. Now, in Egypt, however, the Intifada, the Renaissance, the what you might call the uprising that is taking place on a very massive scale, where while in Tunisia it's 10 million people, but the type of the culture, the type of the people is to a very large extent uniform, and therefore it brought about within Egypt the articulation of the subjected and frustrated and suppressed will who were marginalized felt that they need to be empowered. And although there has been a multiplicity of what you might call opposition groups and parties in Egypt, however, their dispersal, the fact that they are not united, brought the people out, set a slogans and a program, a temporary program or a transitional program, and asked all the groups in who are opposing the regime before that they have to coordinate, if not unite. And therefore, what you have is that the opposition parties, which were split and diversified among themselves, are now following the vanguard of this transformative movement that is taking place and expanding and has sacrificed some of the younger people. And the revolution in the communication and information systems that has animated the young people in Egypt throughout the regions, throughout the governorships, the states, that is, of Egypt, are today forcing the various, the Islamists, the leftists, the communists, the liberals, to come to a common front if they want to be the recipients of the political gains that are taking, are bound to take place when the movement that is, has been initiated in Egypt will realize its objectives.
So is that to say, Ambassador Maksoud, that similar events will take place in Morocco, Yemen, Syria, Jordan, and even Saudi Arabia?
Well, at this moment, we cannot judge, but there is no doubt that what is taking place in Jordan, although the oppression of by the royal family is not as clear and evident, and there is a level of accommodation, so the, it goes against the government rather than the ruling family, because there is a smaller country and there are historical loyalties. However, the demonstrations have been widespread. They have been almost given the fact that Jordan is a small country, have been very impressive and very requirement, and they constitute a great deal of pressure on governments to respond to their desires and their objectives. And the one which is now more or less a candidate to change would be in Yemen. And I think that at that time, all vulnerable societies, for example, in Iraq, where the sectarian divide and the ethnic divide is repulsive to the civil societies in Iraq, I think that might lead to a correction, a corrective process within Iraq. In Lebanon, the sectarian system is still very clear. However, there are new forces that are emerging between civil society and the present political structure, yet that has not yet come to fruition, and the new government that is taking place might be able to respond to the desires of the, but no doubt, there is no doubt at all in my mind that what took place in Tunisia, but more profoundly in Egypt, because Egypt is the biggest, largest country in the Arab world. It lies between Asia, Arab Asia and Arab Africa. It is the cross-fertilizers of human experiences, and whatever progress it takes, then it will undoubtedly become much more speedily infectious. And I think the rebellion in what is taking place today in Yemen is probably the earliest candidate. But as we find that what took place in Tunis as a sort of a surprise, we might find surprises in other countries. But this is what you might call dynamics, searching for a sense of direction. And I think that the search of direction is being provided by the activists, by civil society, by the professional and trade union movements.
Well, I noticed, Ambassador Maksoud, that the Syrian regime that's in many ways similar to the Egyptian regime in as much as it's a kind of dynastic regime, they have responded by cutting off internet and news and increasing food subsidies. And that seems to be fairly common. I believe it's happening in other countries as well. Is that likely to work?
Well, it won't work, but it but what it indicates an anxiety, a level of vulnerability, and therefore it is the only difference is that Egypt has an added dimension in the sense that it has made a treaty with Israel, which has provoked a sense of national dignity, and that which does not obtain in Syria, where they are in a state of belligerency with Israel. That peace treaty, if the transformation takes place, undoubtedly would be seriously challenged, if not otherwise. And that is the situation that ultimately all these are out of the, in a way, a sort of an empowerment of the poor, bringing them back into the mainstream of human development and sustainable development, bringing them back into sharing the wealth which has been taken by corrupt extreme capitalists in Egypt. I think that in that sense, the United States, which is opening up on the freedoms that it wants, freedoms and better governance in Egypt, I think that they would have to realize that they cannot stifle the thing in date what is called stability of the peace treaty with Israel, especially after Israel has shown that it has not only humiliated and suppressed the freedoms and the right of self-determination of the Palestinian people, but it has dictated its terms of establishing settlements, violating international law, UN resolutions and others, and the United States has not been forthcoming into applying its genuine influence because apparently now, especially now, that in Congress the force of the Israeli lobby is quite substantial, and they prioritize the interest of Israel over the interest of fair solution of the Palestinian problem.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Ambassador Clemens Maksoud. Our previous guest from Egypt did say that it was a widespread perception that the United States wants governments like Mubarak's in place because they serve the in Israel security interests. You've just said that those security concerns are now up for grabs. I thank you for joining us here today. Again, I was speaking then with Ambassador Clemens Maksoud, who was the Arab League's ambassador to the United States and the United Nations. I'd like to thank producer Spencer Downing, engineer G. I'll be back tomorrow at 5 p.m. for another background briefing. Bye for now.
Beautiful stars Oscar winner Javier Bardem in an extraordinary performance as a conflicted man who struggles to reconcile fatherhood, love, spirituality.